From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, we go back to Philadelphia and spend some time with our political advisor, political consultant, our the actual political commentator and professor of political science, and the main guy at the Saturday Free School in Philadelphia. This is Professor Tony Montero, and we're going to take a look back. I guess, Tony, first we'll start at the last 2 months. What's happened since the last time we spoke, just after the election?
Well, I'm glad you're back, Don. We need you badly. Well, as you know, the challenge to the 2020 election kind of ended in a way that no one could have expected, with an attack upon the Congress and the disruption of the process of accepting the electors from the various states and thus declaring Biden the winner of the 2020 election. That kind of ended Trump's effort and those in the Congress, the House and the Senate, to look at the 2020 election and whatever malfeasance and other things that went on there. And this then shifted the focus from the 2020 election to the impeachment of Donald Trump, the second impeachment, and then the trial in the Senate.
Okay. But before we go there, let me just flesh out one thing. You know, at the time that the January 6th process, the joint session of Congress, was terminated, and when Biden was ratified by that group as the president of the United States, procedurally, the avenues for Trump to challenge the election closed. There were the possibilities of court challenges. He was denied the opportunity in most cases to even have that based on standing and just a number of procedural devices. And then finally, the big day in court was going to be where people would raise objections to the certification of votes in each of these states, and there would then be a two-hour adjournment into separate House and Senate conversations about the particulars, including testimony. And so the whole world was finally going to see on January 6th some actual discussion of evidence and presentation of evidence on television, and they're going to see Congress witnessing it because it was going to happen at this Megillah. Instead, the attack, some people call it just a swarming, really, of the Capitol that took place on January 6th, was, in essence, it smothered it. It put an end to it. Yeah. So it was a convenient way for people who weren't able to figure out any other way to prevent Trump from finally presenting his case, to once again prevent Trump from finally presenting his case.
Right. And thus a new narrative, a different narrative is imposed upon the situation.
Right.
Now we're looking at a white supremacist sedition to take over the government and to destroy, and I put this in quotes, our democracy.
Yeah. It's the Klan. The actual NAACP lawsuit that we're just hearing about today, the 17th, the basis of the claim is an anti-Ku Klux Klan statute from the 19th century, and they're claiming facts similar to that.
Okay. All right. I hadn't read the lawsuit, but again, it is a diversion. And the Democratic Party and the elite, the regime, if you will, wishes to shift from what is an emerging class conflict. That is not to say there are not other conflicts besetting the society, but definitely to prevent any uniting of working people at any level based upon their common distress, their common poverty and hunger, and the economic conditions that they face, and to now make it as though what was going on and not just what happened at the Capitol, the rally itself was a part of Trump's effort to create or invoke a race war, when in fact it is my opinion that it is the regime, that it is the elites of the Democratic Party who would prefer a race war or race tension to class conflict.
Yeah, you have. I think there are people, I think, who were frozen into a mindset that I guess became apparent, or in any event, is characterized now, looking back, by like the 1930s. You have your communists over here, and then there's the fight that goes on with the good communists and Stalin, or the good communists and Trotsky, depending on which side of that fence you're on. The capitalists, countries that they call the liberal democracies, in the Wilsonian ones in Europe, somehow managed to be democracies, even though they had colonies all over the world that they were killing every day, and the United States, of course. And so their worldview is either you're a liberal Democrat or communist or fascist. Now, looking at fascism, which was supposed to be a distortion, basically, of socialist movement that looked to do exactly what you're talking about, to divide the working class on some other basis, divide the society on some other basis than class, distract them from looking at that class division and class unity as a basis for struggle, and have them fight over other stuff.
That's right. And added to that, to destroy and make illegal and criminalize the parties that were trying to unite the working class.
Yeah.
Here we're talking about Germany in the late 20s and early 30s.
Yes.
To destroy and criminalize those parties,
yes,
in particular the Communist Party of Germany, which generally got about 12% of the vote in elections.
Right. Now, see, this is what's changed. We're just on the same point.
Oh, go
because
ahead.
Because exactly that. Before, those were the parties that were around and the class interests. Since 1930, we've had 80 years, okay? There have been, they were the last 80 years also of human existence, not the first 80 years. So the total accumulation of capital of human history that existed in 1930 has had another 80 years to be piled upon. And the evolution of class dynamics and social activity in general, again, has been piled on top of that, also with the massive technological enhancements like internet and things, and so before, where the distraction was based in, say, in Germany, it was based on the Jews were one object. There were also communists. There were things, though, their unifying thing was their Volk, their nationhood, their people nationhood, that we are one nation. That was like ardent nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
Now, nationalism here in the United States was what was being offered by Trump as Americans versus others, instead of what's being offered by the opponents, which is race, period, and gender, etc. But in other words, the there are two sets of dimensional models of letting society feed upon itself instead of resolving class contradictions. Whereas before, maybe there was only one. Before, nationalism was the thing opposed to internationalism, was the thing opposed to thus international class solidarity, etc. Now you have nationalism being offered as an antidote to the race and other divisions inside the country that are being offered. In other words, Trump offering a unifying model to people inside the United States, where the contradiction is with people outside the United States, and the other being offered is a division inside the United States, and forget about the outside of the United States.
But what we cannot lose sight of is at the core of all of this is neoliberal globalization.
Yeah, exactly.
Which has racked and ruined the working class of all races. The working class today is poorer than it was 40 years ago, and it wasn't doing all that well then. Unions are weaker. The number of people in unions in private industry is the lowest it's been since maybe the 19th century.
Yep.
Certainly since the beginning of organization of industrial unions. So neoliberal globalization is in essence what Trump was talking about.
Yeah.
Not in the most articulate way and not in a class conscious way. Trump merely drew attention to the ruin and immiseration of working people. And they are being ruined. They are being immiserated. And I guess to our initial question, Joe Biden is not going to halt, or his allies or the Democratic Party or the elites in general can do nothing and will do nothing to halt the process of the intensified immiseration and pauperization of working people. And that is the question that drove the 2020 election and drives everything since it.
Yeah.
They had to, and we're now made aware of some of this in the article that was in Time magazine about a week ago,
right,
which kind of points out what the cabal was, the underground effort and organization of the Chamber of Commerce and the AFL-CIO and the Black Lives Matter movement and the non-governmental and non-profit sphere. All of that was brought together in a secret cabal to defeat Trump. And they were prepared, had Trump been reelected, to send their forces into the streets of big cities and burn them down.
Yeah, they announced it. Yeah, I know.
Yeah. So what we're dealing with is a Democratic regime, literally. They hold both houses of Congress and the presidency, that will not repair the damage that has been done to working people over the last 40 years. They will do nothing. I argue it will get worse. And thus a left anchored to identity politics and queer theory and a race theory that separates racial oppression from class oppression, that is basically saying that black working people have more in common with billionaires who are, quote, woke than they do with white working people who we are told are the main force of white supremacy in this society. I think anyone that looks at all of this, the architecture of the ideological and propaganda struggles, cannot help but arrive at a conclusion that Black Lives Matter is not about Black lives, that most of the discussion of white supremacy and white fragility and how to fight racism and all of that is not about anything that it's advertised to be. Mm-hmm. It is about creating the ideological conditions for the ruling class, the neoliberal elite, to wage an unsparing, unconditioned war against working people in this country, irrespective of race, religion, or ethnicity.
I mean, the proof is in the pudding.
Yes.
On the one hand, if you're going to separate class and race from each other and then posit the possibility of solving the problem of race, or then how exactly do you do it if you're going to deny yourself resolution of the class contradiction in the society?
Can. Right. You can.
It's a product
and
of
see,
it.
Yeah. But one thing is for certain. American society is politically fragmenting. But it is also And I would argue that the engine driving the fragmentation and tension in American society is the widening class gap.
Yep.
When a few multi-billionaires control more wealth than 160, or have more wealth than 160 million Americans.
Right.
When the majority of the American people are in or near poverty.
Yep.
What we're looking at. Yep. This is a recipe for an ongoing and deepening class conflict. And how it gets resolved, I couldn't tell you at this point. But this is what we're looking at. And then in the face of all this, a so-called left that has abdicated the field of struggle to the ruling class narrative, and that's across the board. Yeah. There is nothing in the left that would suggest anything other than a version of ruling class propaganda and assumptions about American society.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, you have more people living in poverty and in a precarious state in the United States probably than at any point in history. Well, certainly than any point in history in absolute numbers because of the population differentials. But in terms of condition and the percentage of the society and the overall functioning of the society for the members, whether you use averages or per capita or whatever measurements you're using across it, there's a very few people. When you get to extremes like you just described, there's a very few people that have more than half of the wealth of the country. That means that there's about half of the country that don't have any of the wealth that they're supposed to have.
That's right.
So that's who's desperate. And the first thing that they're going to do is they look up and say, you know, where's the food I'm supposed to be able to feed my child today? And they look up and they see there's a mountain of food that's up past the horizon and towering over it with this guy sitting on top of it polishing a gold bar or something. It's not subtle. And so the kinds of reactions that you're going to get, if I were sitting up there, I would expect that I had a good place to watch things from. Looking at history, it's not a good outcome the way those things get resolved usually for the people on top. And so I think they know their situation and have some major panic that's been induced into them. They're seeing that all of the markers of legitimacy in all of the various institutions, the polling data and everything else, dropping all over the place. And people, the Occupied, even that ragtag group that did it for a minute, occupied the Capitol building for the first time, maybe since the Puerto Ricans shot it up in the early 50s. They don't mention this stuff when they talk about the scale of things that have gone on in Congress and history. Some, because they don't want people to remember that people actually go in there once in a while and shoot those so-and-sos for what they do. Because they don't want that to be part of our memory, because they don't want it to be part of our consideration of things that are possible in the material world. They want to feel beyond, the limits of the material world and where they are as a safe haven, period. I'm looking at AOC, for example, who's been traumatized beyond belief by being two buildings away from these people that swarmed the Capitol building, who will vote on a budget. I don't know, she's been here 4 years now. $700 billion just above ground, another trillion or two or whatever below ground, where all day long they're dropping bombs on people in their huts and blowing them to smithereens. And she does not get traumatized by that one bit and votes aye to approve the money. This is the kind of impunity. Now compare her to like Cheney or somebody, okay? That whole building is full of people who are a magnet for revolutionary activity. And so I think the people behind them know it also. And again, I think they're panicking because, there's just no out for them. At least, not that I say.
No, but I agree with you that if I were a part of the the managerial, technological, bureaucratic elite that themselves are part of the ruling class, the billionaires, and so on. If I were part of that group, I would be deeply concerned about what could possibly happen in this country.
Yep.
There is anger, the likes of which we have not seen in over 100 years in this country, even at the height of the Great Depression.
Yep.
The nation did not fragment in the way it's fragmenting now.
Right.
The political divisions were nowhere near this sharp as they are now.
Yeah.
And that's with all the Communist Party organizing in the South, organizing in industry and auto and steel. With all of that going on, there was nothing close to this. This fragmentation threatens the existence of the state itself.
Mm-hmm.
It is one of those conditions where we called it so many times a crisis of legitimacy. The people do not believe in the major institutions,
right,
be it the Congress, be it the press, be it academia, be it science.
Right.
They just don't believe in anything anymore and are prepared either to withdraw their support or go out and out in attacking those institutions.
Right.
We have not seen this.
Right.
You know, where it goes, you know, who knows right now?
I don't think anyone.
Yeah, everything is quite spontaneous.
And, you know, I just want to get back to this one thing because I didn't resolve it yet. And
I don't mean
just generally. I haven't resolved it. I've been rolling it over in my head for a couple of years, really now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have 80 years of life of, you know, billions of people on top of where the world was at in 1932, and so we're not playing the same game. There's qualitative changes in society. And it's qualitative changes in the things that are on the timeline because, mm-hmm, you know, this thing didn't exist before then, kind of stuff. You know, when you had basically almost a hegemonic control over the planet, when whatever it is that drives history in the direction of autocracy, you know that whole thing, you know, like circular back to the Middle Ages or something, back to feudalism, only even more intensive. When that tendency is, I guess, the angle that goes through fascism, you know, as the fight over the middle class, I guess, and as capitalism, I don't know, deconstructs or advances, depending on your point of view, that you suddenly, instead of having the fullest expression of that and the nation states at war with each other and one winning on top, at the end of it, however you get there, you have one pole now. All right, so they, you know, they won. It's like there was a class war, you know, you won, it's over, now what, kind of a moment. And with you know, the question of putting an opposition to that kind of power, what we've seen, first of all, that the global dynamic has been the rise of multilateralism, you know, in the international stage, China's rise, Russia's, you know, rise, an independent path perhaps rising in with the military in Europe, United Korea, perhaps, you know, this kind of stuff. So that's one thing that's rising, you know, internationally in opposition to the hegemon, you know, finishing its cover the earth job. Also, there's so like nationalism then suddenly becomes a you know, forward, like a progressive thing, not a reactionary thing, because what it's doing is putting an opposition to the hegemon. The you know, the pursuit of China's national interest, the pursuit of Russia's national interest, the pursuit of Europe's national interests, et cetera, against you know, the hegemon's interest, where they are, you know, in opposition, advances multilateralism, advances democracy per se. You know, if it's blocking the hegemon, and so if nationally in the United States, you know, at Hegemon headquarters, somebody decides to try to steer the ship of state in a way that will allow multilateralism to flourish, but they are in essence washing out the hegemon.
That's right. Well, that's what's going on. I mean, you know, we could refer to it as imperial retreat, like Trump's declaration, no more wars of regime change, and his attempt over the objections of the entire Pentagon and most of the elite to quickly withdraw all U.S. troops from Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, and wherever else, and then to attempt to negotiate some sort of peace in East Asia and on the Korean Peninsula, and then not going along with the attempt at color revolution in Russia via Ukraine. Right. I mean, is it that hard to see or understand that he was the least warlike with all of the contradictions of Iran and Venezuela? But in an overall sense, we have never seen anything like it since the Kennedy administration. Every administration has been all out for war.
Yep.
He was not.
And what's interesting, too, you mentioned Ukraine. Actually, whoever was doing costumes for Ukraine for that whole, you know, that whole play that went on there couldn't have chosen the costumes better to hit us over the head to show us who's on which sides.
Right.
The hegemon, the Democratic Party, Obama, Biden, Hillary Clinton, Victoria Nuland, Jeffrey Pyatt, placed into power in Ukraine, guys wearing actual Nazi costumes, goose-stepping. Okay, the choreographer was teaching them how to goose-step, like Bandera, et cetera, et cetera. And Trump was the one that they tried to crucify. From the other side. The first impeachment was about him looking to investigate what happened there.
Yeah. But the good thing is, that it's just like with the children who have not been able to go to school because of the COVID-19 and how everybody admits that it will be very, very difficult, if not impossible, for many of them to ever catch up to where they should be in terms of their learning and so on and so forth.
Right.
Well, the same thing goes for the United States. The U.S. and the West has lost so much ground to China and Asia and the Belt and Road Initiative and the Regional Comprehensive Trade Agreement, the largest trade agreement in history among East Asian countries. The U.S. has lost so much ground, the dollar has lost so much ground, that I think now when we talk about the world, we will not be able to talk about a single hegemon. We are now inevitably going to have to talk about a bipolar world with multiple currencies and new conditions of trade, production, and human rights. I think the damage to the West, in a lot of ways brought on by Trump, the damage to NATO, and on has been tremendous. The world will never be the same. The world capitalist system will never again hold the position that it has held. Now, of course, they have one option, and that is the option of war. And that is what we must prevent while fighting for progress.
And that's where we're going to pick it up next week. Professor Montero, thank you very much. We now have an agenda set for our discussions going forward. Take care.
All right. Thank you, Don. Appreciate it.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.